Welcome to episode 36 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson, Michael Lucas Smith, and David Buck. This week we discussed less is more, how less in Smalltalk amounts to more productivity and more interesting code while actually writing less actual code. Ironically, we went long this week because you can never talk too much about how less is more. Hope you enjoy the podcast. If you do, please head on over to Podcast Alley and toss a vote our way, or head on over to iTunes and give us a review. Thanks. Welcome to episode 36 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson, Michael Lucas Smith, and David Buck. This week we discussed less is more, how less in Smalltalk amounts to more productivity and more interesting code while actually writing less actual code. Ironically, we went long this week because you can never talk too much about how less is more. Hope you enjoy the podcast. If you do, please head on over to Podcast Alley and toss a vote our way, or head on over to iTunes and give us a review. Thanks. I was just explaining the 7-second lost update. There's a YouTube video out on it. It gives the lost music for about 2 seconds, the lost screen with the lost word in diagonal for about 2 seconds, and then shows Charlie saying, "Where are we?" And that gets you pretty much up to date with the last 3 seasons.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, so with that as an update, I think this week what our topic was going to be was something along the lines of less is more. The idea being that Smalltalk tries to accomplish more with less, and a bunch of things we were going to go along with was things like how to accomplish more with fewer things being immediately obvious, say, in user interface, the way dynamic polymorphism plays into that, keyword messages, all that kind of stuff. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with some ideas on the whole less is more thing as far as anything you have in mind?
I know I came up with the topic.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking you.
I didn't think this far through. I mean, less is more. Smalltalk code, especially with keyword selectors, is very descriptive. So when you see a Smalltalk programmer write, unless they're a crap one, they'll actually write more code. They'll spell out the selector names in full. They'll spell out variables in full. They'll declare instance variables in full, temporary variables in full, because they have to type less code to achieve more so they can be more descriptive in their code. Is that your experience, Dave?
Yeah, in fact, Smalltalk, since it has less syntax, it allows you to accomplish more with the syntax that it does allow.
No, less syntax isn't the reason, though. I mean, Lisp has the least amount of syntax of anything, and they abbreviate everything.
Right. But, okay, well, there are a couple things that play in here. One is the existence of blocks and the closures in Smalltalk. And I find that gives you a very much of an abbreviating feel to the language, that it allows you to say things that you can't say otherwise. Things like, to a dictionary, you can say at if absent put. So go look up an element, and if it's not there, put this thing in.
Well, that actually plays into something that Michael mentioned on the chat that we were in before you came along, which is that Smalltalk really makes it easy for you to build new control structures, where in most other languages you can't build a control structure that is at the same level of abstraction as the control structures that are built into the language. You know, so if you're using a language like Java or C# or VB, you can build your own control structures, as it were, in your own classes, but they don't live at the same level of granularity as the ones that are built in, because those are built-in pieces of syntax.
There's the tect if none, which is a very, very commonly used method in Smalltalk. And the idea is that it'll iterate through a collection, and it'll run a block of code. So this is some anonymous piece of code you've given it, to test against each element in the collection sequentially. And if it matches, it returns at that point with what it found. If it gets to the end of the collection without having found anything that matches your block, it'll run the if none block. So that allows you to be very succinctly go, people detect if person's name equals blah, if none, create person with the name of blah. And the code is almost exactly what I just said there. And for an example of adding another control structure that would simplify the code flow even more, I often add detect if person if none, actually detect if found if none, which does the same iteration to see if it found something. Instead of returning with the result at that point, it'll call the found block that you've given it with the thing that it found. So that gives you a very clear if true, if false sort of structure there. Find something, if it's true that we found it, do this. If it's false that we didn't, true that we didn't find it, in other words, if it's false that we didn't find it, do this. And you can do that kind of control structure with all kinds of stuff. So I really like that. I mean, again, that's something you can do in Lisp, but Lisp doesn't have a syntax for block closures. You've got to write lambda out, or there are a couple other tricks you can use, but it's really core to Smalltalk. I guess the real trick is that lambdas are a thing that were added to Lisp, and the base libraries have nothing to do with lambdas, whereas the base libraries in Smalltalk use lambdas / block closures consistently everywhere. I mean, it's the one most used structure in Smalltalk.
Yeah, I think there's something else that plays into it too, and that is that in Smalltalk, if I have a new control structure like that that I want to add to a collection class, I can just go ahead and slap it into class collection and then have every collection in the system understand it and maybe customize it for subclasses that need it. But the point is that I can add it right there at the same level as all of the other control structures that exist. Whereas, you know, you can do something similar to this in a language like even C with function pointers, but I can't have it at the same level of, I can't have it at the same built-in kind of feel that, say, you know, something like a for loop has in C.
Well, I mean, if you look at, say, Java. Is my computer on? Can you guys hear me? Good.
I can hear you, yes.
Yep. If you look at something like Java, you can't add a method to string that does something like convert string to camel case. What you do is you make a string util class. You're giving up OO and doing procedural, and you're not. And now you've got to write more code to do what you wanted to do. So being able to put your protocols on anyone else's classes, that's not just base classes. It's if I pick up something from James and I want access to something that he hasn't given me access to, I can extend it as well. And yeah, that allows you to write less code to be more expressive as well.
The new version of C# allows you to have what they call partial classes, which is something similar to class extensions. It allows you to add methods in, but those methods belong to another file. The problem is that in that mechanism, the original class declaration has to be declared as a partial class so that the compiler knows to look elsewhere for extensions to add into it.
That plays into something that you can talk and talk and talk to people in the industry and get basically two different opinions about, and that is, you know, the difference between, on the one hand, you get people who will tell you more or less the library designer is God, and he knows everything about everything that the library will ever be used for, and that's why he declared some classes final, and that's why he shipped only binary, and that's why he didn't give you source, and that's why he didn't make it possible for you to add methods like that, even in a language like C#, say, that gives you that capability. He said nobody will ever need that, so he didn't bother adding that functionality. In Smalltalk, even if the library designer didn't think you ever needed that capability, you can just go in, like Michael was saying a few minutes ago, and say, well, he didn't know everything. I can go ahead and add that functionality myself because, in fact, I'm using this in a way he didn't foresee.
In fact, C# takes that problem one step further. One of the weird things about C# is that unless you specify otherwise, a method in a superclass is not overridable in the subclass. It can't be called polymorphically. You have to declare the superclass method as overridable.
The default is for it not to be overridable?
That's correct.
Oh, wow.
The default is that it's not overridable and that you have to explicitly say it's overridable before you can call it polymorphically from, call subclass methods polymorphically with a superclass method. So this is all because of Microsoft's paranoia of the fragile base class problem. They think that if they don't do this, then people are going to subclass from their classes and override things that they're not allowed to override and run code they're not allowed to or not supposed to run, and then screw things up in some ways that Microsoft can't anticipate. So therefore, they're not going to allow you to do it at all.
Yeah, I almost wonder if this doesn't really have... I think that mindset has less to do in some ways with software development than it does just with a general outlook on the world kind of thing, that there are some people that think you ought to give people the tools to be responsible, and if they blow their own feet off, well, they blow their own feet off, and those kinds of people are comfortable using languages even like C and C++ because you can blow your feet clean off in those languages, and they're comfortable using Smalltalk because you can blow your feet off in Smalltalk.
There's an interesting quote, actually.
Blow your feet off again, James.
What's that?
Just say blow your feet off again, James.
There was an interesting quote Alan Knight came up with recently. I guess we were chatting. I said, well, you can really shoot yourself in the foot with that technique. He says, yes, but in Smalltalk, you can take your foot, examine it, and stick it back on. He said, you can't do that in any other language.
Yeah, and I, like I said, I think this is kind of a philosophical difference that a lot of people have, that they believe you should not allow that capability to end developers because their theory is that the end developers are mostly morons. I've related this story before, but I was at a conference probably 3-4 years ago, and this was when Joshua Block was still at Sun. He was giving a keynote about API design, and I came up to him after the talk and asked him about the whole concept of final classes and how I thought that was just a bad idea. And he told me that Smalltalkers could handle having easily extensible classes and Java developers couldn't, because it was his considered opinion that by and large Java developers were made up of mostly morons. Obviously, I don't want to put those words exactly in his mouth because that's not completely what he said, but that really was the implication I got out of the way he explained things to me.
Yeah, in fact, that feeling was reflected again by Chad Fowler at the Smalltalk Solutions conference this year when he said that, I think we mentioned this quote before, Java is a programming language that assumes that the developer doesn't know what he's doing, basically.
Right. It's not that all Java developers are stupid. It's that the language is designed with that assumption in mind.
Right. So I find an interesting philosophical difference between Smalltalk developers, typically, and other developers, where Smalltalkers tend to write very, very short methods, and in other languages, people tend to write very long methods. In Smalltalk, I did an analysis of a system once. A good 70% of the methods were 3 lines and less, and then the rest were up in the sort of the noise region. Now, that's not counting things like Windows specs that are built automatically for you.
Gosh forbid it's not counting anything found in Class UI Builder, too.
There's a huge number of methods in the system that are just one-line and two-line methods. And that seems to be the standard way of developing, which is one that I actually prefer.
It means
You can look at a method and at a glance see what it does and see and understand the method.
It's less likely to have a bug if the method is quite explicitly called hammer nailed into wall, and then you look at the code and it says lift wall and press against hammer with nail balanced on hammer. You quickly, very, very quickly realize, wait a second, we're trying to hammer the nail into the wall, and here we're trying to move the wall against the hammer with the nail on it. In C programs, and I guess many other programming languages, the message about what you're trying to achieve is generally lost. Like our lost update. But yeah, I mean, small methods are the thing. I mean, that's it. But the tools don't really help you if in other programming languages. If you have a look at the way most people program when they're using source code files, the source code file is all locality-based. Stuff that calls one thing will be near another thing. And they do this because the tools don't let you easily jump around between things. And even when you've got implementers and senders implemented into your IDE, they'll still do this trick because it's quicker for them. And the main reason that they need that access is because the method is usually the length of the screen big.
Yeah. I was having this conversation actually out on the golf course yesterday with a friend of mine who mostly writes in C#. And we were talking about the difference between the way I write code and the way that he writes code using IntelliSense-capable editors. And I was trying to get the point across to him that things like IntelliSense, this is not that IntelliSense isn't valuable. We have similar capabilities that are loadable into Syncom Smalltalk, and while it's not as capable as what you have, say, in Java or C#, it does pretty darn well considering that it's a dynamic language, and from what I understand, the stuff they have built into Dolphin is pretty darned impressive.
Oh, we got some ideas about that for VisualWorks, but I'm not going to talk about that at this point.
Okay.
We can make a pretty good IntelliSense system for VW.
But be that as it may, the interesting thing is, IntelliSense, I think, while it's I'm not going to say that it's useless, it's not. It's highly valuable for people using it. But it was built to a very large extent first in languages with static typing, I think, because those languages really needed that kind of ability to help people figure stuff out. And this gets into something else I wanted to mention. That's keyword messages. If you're writing a keyword message, it's very, very difficult when you're writing point X colon Y colon to mix up where the X and Y goes, because the method name tells you exactly what goes where. And if you look at most methods in Smalltalk, most people who are writing Smalltalk write methods that explain very explicitly, just like you just said, not only what they do, but explain very explicitly in the keywords which arguments they take and where they take those arguments. Whereas if you're looking at, say, the Oracle API, if you look at the API to Oracle, which, you know, we've got one in Smalltalk that interfaces out to the OCI, you look at some of those function calls that take 10, 15 arguments. I don't know if I was writing that. I'd have to have a manual next to me to know which integer went where, which function pointer went where.
This is actually a very interesting point, that the whole duck typing issue kind of comes in here as well. In those languages where you have multiple parameters, the parameter types are very useful, except where you've got too many of them, and then you need to describe what each parameter means by name. But usually, the arguments are, you know, this structure, that structure, and this string, and these flags. So the types actually help you a lot. But in Smalltalk, we don't type the arguments to methods at all. So what you find is the keyword selectors will describe the role of the variable. And the role of the variable is all about duck typing. It doesn't matter what you give it, so long as it can fill that role. For example, if we want to pass in the nail, then we're talking about something that you can drive into a wall with a hammer. There are umpteen things in the world that could be used to do that. And this comes back to the whole premise that objects and classes can model the world, that most people in OO languages other than Smalltalk say, well, that's a rubbish idea, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because they're not doing what real world does, which is allowing duck typing, essentially. If you can hammer it into the wall, then that's an acceptable parameter and we don't have to say anything more. The computer doesn't need to know. The person knows that if they're hammering a squirrel into the wall, it's going to go splat. And that's actually another very interesting point, is that if you decided to hammer a squirrel into the wall, because for whatever reason that was what the 3D world environment suddenly allowed you to do because you're in Second Life and Second Life's using duck typing and someone picks up a squirrel and a hammer and goes up to a wall. This is the kind of dynamic reactive environment that we want our programs to be able to handle, because if you hammer a squirrel against a hard surface, it's going to go splat. It's not going to break the program. The program shouldn't crash. It should just have a different outcome than actually getting the squirrel into the wall. I know this is a very bad example, but I'm just trying to get the point across about what duck typing really means.
Yeah, well, I'll go actually back to what I was talking about with this friend of mine yesterday. He was one of the things I think the static languages tend to encourage that he brought up in the conversation was that in order to get around the problem of having, say, a function that would otherwise take two or three different values all of the same type, they'll go ahead and declare multiple types or multiple classes to handle each one. And so you end up with this kind of explosion of types in your system in order to allow you to differentiate, whereas in Smalltalk, we handle that just with naming. So I think it's a little more lightweight.
Yeah, I've heard that approach before, where rather than having a method with, let's say, four string parameters, you'd have a method that takes one parameter, which is effectively a string, but it's put into a, let's say, an URL object, and then another parameter that's into a file name object, and then you have to pass the right kind of object into the method in order for the type checking to work.
Right, which is good. I mean, you're dealing with real objects there. I mean, that's a good thing. I mean, if it really is a URL, it should be a URL. If it really is a file, it should be a file. I see that as a very good practice.
True, but in some cases, the things that need to be passed in, probably it was a bad example, but the things that need to be passed in really were fundamentally just strings. And they create additional classes.
This would be like making a class for last name and first name.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, okay, right.
Yeah. I think if you look also in Smalltalk, what you'll see throughout the system is you'll see people being able to pass simple things like strings in and have the system just go ahead and make sure they're the right kind of object when they get where they're needed. You see this constantly with things like file names and URLs.
Yes.
Yeah, which isn't right. It should be a bit more trusting than that. There's very few cases where you really, really need to double check what it is you're... See, I mean, there's two ways to check. You can ask something as type, or you can ask it a message that it has to understand. And really, both scenarios have to have an error. And either the error is throw an error, return nil, or do it does not understand. And they're the three kind of outcomes you can have. If you return nil, then you just throw an exception back up to the caller that they have to handle. If you throw an error, then again, you're throwing an exception that the caller has to handle, or somebody up the chain has to handle. A little bit more flexible than the nil thing. And finally, the does not understand just says, well, okay, you should have understood it. And when you start changing your code around to work like that, where you stop asking whether it's the right thing and just assume it is and ask it to do something, then other people can give it types that you never thought of. And it also means you end up with less code. So less is more here. You end up with less code because you're not doing type checks everywhere. You're assuming that the path will be followed correctly. And the nice thing is that when you write tests or actually use the software, you always get the right path followed correctly, or it stops very quickly because the domain, well, I guess the ontology isn't understood. And again, this comes back to the whole idea of the duck typing and truly letting the system just do what it needs to do. But I guess you can't really grasp it unless you program with the idea that you're going to name your methods non-generic things and make them a specific domain about what you're dealing with. If you just name things generic, like every class responds to apply, and apply means something in different contexts, that's really bad programming style. If you give each kind of object the kind of action you want to perform, such as, you know, hammer it, throw it, kick it, so on and so forth, then things that can be kicked, and things that can be thrown, and so on and so forth. You know, if you make it explicit, you pour a little bit of cement where the cement belongs, as opposed to making everything fluffy framework, you get a lot out of your program and you end up with less code.
Well, you know, I think you see other languages, other approaches trying to solve the same problem by throwing complexity at the issue. If you look at your mainstream languages, they both built generic systems. C++ has a generic system, too, of massive complexity. And they're trying to solve the duck typing problem in a way that doesn't toss their static typing system out the window. But what it does is it just layers a lot of complexity onto their system that a language like Smalltalk or Python or Ruby just doesn't have, because we're not worried about the basic issue of having to associate static types with everything that stumbles along.
Well, there's a difference. If you pass in the wrong kind of type in their system, the program will actually crash and quit. That's where it comes down to the fundamental here. What happens when the wrong thing happens?
Yeah, you get memory corruption, or your system will suddenly shut down on you, and you can't handle the exception.
Well, that actually brings another thing to mind for me, and that's exception handling. I think in most systems, when you get an exception, by the time you get back to your handler, the stack is already unwound and you don't have access to it. Whereas if you're in Smalltalk, you have access to that stack. You can do all kinds of entertaining things. I did some screencasts on this last week where you can just return a different value. You can go ahead and tell it to try the block that you were protecting over again, because whatever problem you had was fixed. You know, maybe you were dividing by zero because you took some input from the end user, and you say, well, if they divide by zero, then let's throw them a default value and try it again. Or you can do something even more interesting. You can say, well, instead of trying the initial protected block, here's a different block you can try and just run with that one instead and keep chugging along. Smalltalk, because it doesn't toss that stack away, allows you to do all kinds of entertaining things at runtime that you really can't do at runtime in any of these other systems, because that stack has already disappeared by the time you get to your handler.
Yeah, the handler is called from the routine that raised the exception as a separate stack frame underneath the exception. So it's as if the exception, the method calling the exception or raising the exception, called out to the handler. And so all your stack frame is still there. With Java, it will unwind until it sees the handler. And at that point, it's too late. You've already destroyed all your environment. You can't proceed or continue with it. So,
since we're talking about stupid things in C#, can I just point out how stupid it is that any method that can raise an exception, if you're calling it, you have to either handle the exception or specify that you also pass the exception on? I think that is so daft.
That's a Java thing as well.
That's Java. Is that in C# as well?
I don't think that's in C#.
I didn't think so. It's definitely Java.
That's a Java throws declaration for the method. And that's one that's been causing a lot of controversy. Apparently, a lot of people are switching to, what are they called?
Checked and unchecked exceptions, is it?
The unchecked exceptions. There's another name for it, but I can't bring it to my mind right now. Basically, exceptions that don't require you to declare that you're throwing them.
Yeah, it's not a real exception, but it's an exception. It's an interesting workaround.
Well, it's like I was saying earlier about the way they were layering on generics. They're trying to solve the same problem we already solved in the dynamic language system, but they're doing it by layering more complexity on, because it's kind of like having a big consulting project that spent $100 million, and rather than declaring it a failure and sending everybody home, they'll just throw another $50 million at it and hope something comes out the other end.
Well, that's the partial classes thing in C#, isn't it? I mean, they could have just said, this is desired behavior, why don't we allow all kinds of classes to do this sort of behavior? But instead, they went and stuck another kind of class on the side.
And it's, again, a fear of we don't want to let the end programmers do things that will destroy our work as the system programmers.
Although they're in a unique position where they could have isolated every program, which is something that I wish Smalltalk could do. So such that, you know, a program could decide to change some low-level thing in the C-sharp run environment and not affect any other program. But they didn't go that route. Instead, they actually spent a lot of time. They could have spent their time figuring out how to do that nicely and fast. In fact, the S-sharp guy, David Simmons, did figure that out and did implement that. But they spent a lot of their time with the big kind of security front end that when your program starts up, it links through everything. And now that they're starting to get into DLR dynamic language stuff, all of that work is completely useless.
Well, to some extent, when you're talking about sandboxing here, just tell me what you mean. I'm wondering, are you talking about things like cloning objects in sort of the same way that Self does, or are you talking about something else?
No, I'm talking about being able to implement my own string class and have all of my code use that string class, or change the method is nil and have only my code do that is nil, yet have all the other Smalltalk code in the system continue running. So what happened in C-sharp was that when you interface to a class, you get a kind of, I'm not sure whether you did a linked list or a copy, probably a copy of the interface to that class in your execution space, such that you can modify it in any way you want. And any code running in your execution space uses your tables. So you can completely redefine the entire system and not affect any other programs running in the same VM, which is a really cool thing. I mean, that's kind of the ultimate namespacing and sandboxing. That's really cool. And, you know, it would have been nice if Microsoft had gone and done that work, but they were too busy trying to catch up to the very idea of having a VM as a language.
Well, actually, in Smalltalk, so you guys can explain to me how off the wall this idea is. It doesn't sound to me, from my limited experience based on this, that it would be that difficult to at least do a proof of concept. You could take an object and sort of hand it its own method dictionary and stuff things in there, couldn't you?
I already did that. I made an object in the VW virtual machine, in the running image, that was its own class. So it had its own method dictionary on it as an instance variable, and you could add behavior into that, and that would run. But that's not really the point. The whole idea is that the entire system will run this way.
Yeah, I'm just saying that if you do it as a proof of concept, you could probably run an entire system that way if you designed it up that way.
Yeah. I mean, systems like Self lend themselves a bit better to this sort of approach.
Of course, as I said last week, getting from here to there is just a small matter of code.
A small matter of code, yes. One small thing I find that makes a difference in the readability and simplicity of Smalltalk versus the mainstream languages is the choice of the separator for message names. In Smalltalk, you use spaces. In other languages, you use dots. So in other languages,
very crowded.
Yeah, you tend to say my customer dot address dot first line. Now that's breaking encapsulation, mind you, but you tend to use those dots a lot. In Smalltalk, to send messages, you would put a space in. So you'd say, my customer address first line, and it reads a lot better.
Yeah, now it's oversimplifying to say that it reads more like English, but it does read more like English.
Can I just change the topic a little bit? I mean, it's still less is more, but a different kind of angle to it. And that's this goal that, well, not really a goal. It's actually an actuality. My most productive days are days when I'm wiping code, not writing code. I mean, I think we may have mentioned that before, but it sounds strange, but it's true.
Yeah, it's a good day when you get rid of a lot of code.
So the system
still works the same way.
Yeah, or better. Often you do more.
I was just inspired to do that by a conversation we had on the IRC a couple of days ago. In Bottom Feeder, I just whacked out a whole bunch of settings because I'd had you, Michael, tell me a number of times that you thought that I had gone completely nuts with how many dials and switches I had added to the application over time. And I
it took you how many years to figure that out?
Well, you know, I'm just a simple product manager over here. But, you know, the thing is that it occurred to me finally that most of those settings were things that there are probably one or two experts that actually know what they mean. And those one or two experts are usually me because I'm the one that designed the stupid thing. And most people just look at them and probably wonder, what in God's name is that? And if I changed it, what would happen? So I left all those settings in from the standpoint of the settings file. So if you actually have some idea what those things mean, you can go to the file and edit it. But from the user interface standpoint, I took out the settings so that only the ones that are fairly inherently obvious are left. And I was going to start doing the same thing with the menu structure, because I think the same problem exists for the menu structure, is there's too many options there as well. And I think that applies to an awful lot of applications, not just ones that I've written. I mean, I think to some extent this is why Microsoft, as much as I've complained about it, I think this is why Microsoft went to the ribbon. And I think this is why an awful lot of new applications you see tend to have a much more spare user interface, because the idea truly is that from the standpoint of most end users, dials and knobs and switches just confuse them, not because they're stupid, but because they don't have the same mental framework for the application that the developer had.
Right. It's all about utilitarian design. Make it for a job, not for any job. Very difficult to do. I mean, I guess the last 10 years of computing, or I guess the last 15 years of computing, excluding the last 5 years of computing, has been about, wow, this computer can do everything. Therefore, the program can do everything. So, but recently, the explosion of users, the user-based computing, has exploded massively. And the majority of users, by a very, very large percentage now, don't want to do everything. They want to do things. They want the computer to be able to act like a phone and be able to act like a record player. And that record player shouldn't have 50 dials on it, and the phone shouldn't have 100 buttons on it. It should come back to the metaphor of what it's actually about. So that's very tricky to do. And a lot of programs are very information heavy when they don't have to be. Most applications that are information systems will gladly give you a giant tabular view of dozens of columns and thousands of rows of stuff, instead of taking the time to take that information and figure out what's actually going to be useful about this. Oh, well, we can graph these bits, and we don't ever have to show them the data unless they explicitly ask for it. And that's the difference, I guess, in the last 10 years between an information system and an expert system, is the guys who wrote the expert system would take the time to go and figure out how can we expertly show this information so that an executive can glance at it for 5 seconds and know everything they need. And the manager down the hall spends hours staring at the list of data. Well, the manager down the hall doesn't even have time to stare at the list of data anymore. In fact, not even the IT guy running the software has time to stare at your list of data when something goes wrong. So it's a very different way of designing software, and it comes back to something that was happening before computers came along in textual representations of stuff, where, say, take train timetables. They used to put up a giant board of times for trains' arrival departures in a big tabular form on the wall. Then someone got smart and started using graphics to represent it. And they took a timeline and showed a blob that indicates the travel. So the travel would indicate the travel time along a particular rail, and they could write inside that blob which train it was, and they could put the lines on the wall as the rows, and the columns is actually the timeline. So what that meant was someone could very quickly look at the wall and see not only when the train was coming, which train was coming, what platform to be on, but what train they're going to take next to get to their final destination. Now, I bring this particular example up because recently I saw a guy talking about exactly this sort of stuff with computing and how important it is to reduce data glut and use graphics, because we've got this, you know, these mega powerful machines that can do this stuff.
You're referring to a website that you sent me a link to probably 2 months ago, and you're going to have to see if you can turn that up again and send it to me so I can put it as a link in the post that I put up with this podcast.
Okay, it's called Magic Ink. I'm hesitant to throw the link out there because the guy rants significantly. the rant quotient is massive. But what the guy did was he took these ideas and recreated them in software and demonstrated existing software that had been written by people using the classic information systems approach in comparison to what he had done. Now, what he had done took a lot more work, but the result was so much better. You could very quickly in the San Francisco area see how to get from A to B, put those times up and keep that route, and also have that route, whichever way you want to say it, reverse itself depending on time of day. So in the morning I go here, and then the evening it reverses itself so I can go home. Little things like that, time-based information systems, information that's represented in a graphical form. And finally, he also hooked it up to a map system that showed the actual route that you would be taking if you took that that train thing. So the timeline was particularly useful because it was oriented to now. So if you look at the timeline, okay, I want to get to where I'm going, and I know it takes me 5 minutes to walk to the station, which means I'm going to be taking this set of trains. And it was all just there. Boom. And that's very interesting that it's taken this long to get back to what was widely accepted as best practice on with pen and paper.
Mm-hmm. Are we back to there yet?
Well, we're going there. We're getting there. I mean, it's coming along. You see this stuff mostly in the Mac world where they're trying to build applications for general people. On the PC world, it's a very hodgepodge sort of thing. Microsoft doesn't do it. So the base that you get with the operating system isn't about people. It's about the computer and the information in the computer and the internet. So it's a very different way of looking at things. And I get the impression that some people, very influential people at Microsoft, are starting to clue in on this and change the direction of the company from what I've heard about their plans for the next version of Windows after the next version of Windows. So that's kind of a joke, but it's not a joke at the same time. That's literally what they said. So somebody said that we should talk more about other small talks as well as VisualWorks.
Yeah, and I should put a link up to the Weekly Squeak. I put this up in one of my blog posts last week. They've run a series of interesting interviews. So for more information outside of CINCOM Smalltalk and outside of other the small talks we normally talk about here, the Weekly Squeak is a good place to look.
So the latest highlights for the past weeks, two major software releases to be celebrated. Croquet 1.0, I guess that's a pretty major thing. I hadn't actually heard that. I would have thought there would have been a bit more hoopla at that.
I barely noticed it, yeah.
Yeah, Plop as well, although a serial number is required for full functionality. So I guess that's a trial sort of thing. And they say here, the Squeak projects for this year's Google Summer of Code are out. Five projects have been selected, supporting both the developer-oriented stuff and user-oriented stuff. So they've got a new compiler, a more pluggable compiler, I should say, the package model. They don't actually have a package model in Squeak, so I guess that's something they want to do. More collaborative development stuff so that they can share their images better, I guess. Another wiki. God knows we don't have enough wikis. And a HTML CSS viewer. So they're the Google Summer of Code Squeak projects.
Alrighty. Well, on that note, I think we'll wrap it up for the week.
Okay, see you later, guys. See you next week.
Thanks.
Goodbye, guys.
Bye.
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 Stay tuned for this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report with James Savage.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. I had to spend much of my time this past week solving an outgoing email problem. However, thanks to the efforts of our intrepid team of volunteers, I have some new positions to report on this week. London, UK. Job Search is looking for a developer who has experience with OO systems and VBScript. Experience in other OO languages, agile software development experience, and Smalltalk are considered pluses. Addison, Texas. The Hiring Assistant, Inc. is looking for a senior OO 4GL consultant who has a wide range of experience that includes Smalltalk. New York, New York. K-Force Technology Staffing is looking for a capital financial developer who has experience with banking or financial services, financial derivatives interest or experience, OOAD, and Smalltalk. Plainfield, New Jersey. Precision System Design is looking for a senior Smalltalk developer for a 6-plus-month contract. Suffolk, Virginia. Precision System Design is looking for a Smalltalk developer for a permanent position. Experience with Visual Age, Oracle, and Java are considered pluses. Pullman, Washington. Switzer Engineering Laboratories, Inc. is looking to fill multiple software engineer positions with people that have experience with embedded software and a wide range of other experience that includes Smalltalk. These are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
Well, that about wraps up this week's Industry Misinterpretations. Hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please head on over to Podcast Alley, toss a vote. Head on over to iTunes, leave a review, or send feedback to smalltalkpodcasts@cincom.com. Thanks from all of us.